Hello, all you wonderfully strange and unusual creatures.
I'm Corey.
And I'm Courtney. And this is Sinister Crimes and Cocktails, a true crime show that digs into the dark depths of sinister minds, their menacing crimes, and mistakes left behind, all while sipping on a sinister cocktail masterminded by Corey for each episode.
We want to first start out by saying that our sinister cocktails featured for each episode is just to help us lighten the mood a bit on the dark and horrific crimes we cover. And in no way, shape, or form are we trying to make light of the horrific crimes. Please know our hearts go out to the victims, their families and friends, and law enforcement affected by each of the cases we cover.
Okay, Corey, what sinister cocktail have you masterminded for today's episode, kicking off the month of April with another round of serial killers?
I'm calling this one a quiet killer. 1 1/2 ounces of peanut butter whiskey, 1/2 ounce of amaretto liqueur, 3 ounces of cereal milk, and 1/2 ounce of chocolate syrup. You can combine all this together in a shaker with some ice and give it a good shake. Double strain it into a glass of your choice. Top with some whipped cream and chocolate syrup and enjoy.
And it's so good. You did a really good job on this. I absolutely love it.
It's really, really good. And just for our listeners' knowledge, we are going to be doing cereal milk cocktails this month with our cereal killers. So we're going to have some fun on this.
Yes, and I'm so excited about this. These are my favorite cocktails.
I know. They're super good and super delicious. Indulgent for sure.
So excited. And I have to say too, this one that you did today,
I know.
Perfect. And you know, I love that peanut butter whiskey too.
Oh yeah, it's good. It's delicious.
So all you strange and unusual creatures, pour yourself a cocktail and settle in for this sinister true crime. The Taco Bell serial killer. Believe us, you're going to need it. The most infamous serial killer in the history of North Carolina is that of Henry Louis Wallace, also known as the Charlotte Strangler or the Taco Bell Killer. During the early 90s, Wallace murdered nearly a dozen black women who almost all had one thing in common. They knew him. For several years, he remained at large, causing hysteria in the city of Charlotte, especially amongst the minority community where a large number of the murders had taken place. A lack of adequate police patrolling in that area of Charlotte and the fact that the police were simply not equipped in handling a serial killer allowed Wallace's rampant murdering spree to continue for so long. He would eventually be caught and during his confession, explained how he raped and strangled each of his victims to death, even attending some of his victims' funerals. When Wallace was finally convicted of raping and murdering 10 black women, he was sentenced to death where he still remains on death row. So, what would cause such a sinister mind to commit such horrific murders?
So, I'm really excited about this one, Court, because he's still alive.
Yes,
he's still on death row.
You can interview him.
I know. I'm so excited about this one. I mean, seriously, I'm going to have to figure out a way to get over there and talk with him. But, you know, what's interesting, too, about this is that you really get to see the charismatic side of a serial killer with this guy. He likes to talk. He likes to tell him what he did and how he did it. And he needed that notoriety and the attention that we often see in serial killers when you look at their cases and stuff. So this guy's a kind of a textbook perfect picture of that, with his wanting the attention, telling him detail by detail of what happened, how he did it, why he did it. So very interesting stuff.
Yes, except for the fact that he is not the typical serial killer in the way of his race and victims.
Yes. So yes, his methods and are very much typical, but his MO is very different. His typology of victims is very different than what we see in normal serial killers. Him himself is very different than what we see in normal serial killers as far as demographics go. But he's still a very interesting case.
Oh,
a very textbook in a lot of ways of, I like the attention. I have to have the attention because that's what feeds my need of doing what I do.
Absolutely. See, Dad, I didn't cuss there. Welcome. That's what we talked about when I went up there this past week, and you cuss a lot still.
Try not to, promise.
Corey doesn't. I was like,
sometimes I drop it. Do you keep cutting my cuss words out, Courtney? Keep editing my cuss words out.
Keeping you looking like the golden child.
Oh, I've never been proclaimed that before in my life.
I bet your parents would agree. Sorry, I can cut that.
No, you're right. They wouldn't. I've never been claimed on that one.
Henry Louis Wallace was born on November 4th, 1965 in Barnwell, South Carolina. He was raised by a single mother, Lottie May, who worked long hours as a textile worker. The home in which Wallace grew up in did not have electricity or plumbing. The family drank from a pump well, and their bathroom was really a watershed with a set of chamber pots. What the actual fuck?
Imagine growing up and living like that. But you know, that's very, very common for the people in that area back in those times, because
it's 1965, they have indoor plumbing, Corey.
They do, but you have to understand is that you still had a very deep-seated racism going on in that area, and they were kept in a very, very not sanitary, not kind of the upper side where you would have indoor plumbing. They were still living in the slave houses that were built back in the, you know, 1800s, 1900s, early 1900s, you know, that's where they were still living at. I mean, that's the sad part of this.
The home was shared not only with his mother and older sister, but as well as his grandmother. With the family having little money, Wallace was given his older sister's clothing when he outgrew his own. That's kind of fucked up.
Yeah, but I mean, was he wearing dresses or?
I'm pretty sure he was.
I would have loved to know that. Are you wearing dresses or are you wearing pants? Like, what's happening here? Are we taking the dresses, turning them into pants? Like, what are we doing?
Later, we'll find out.
What's grandma doing too? Can she not sew some pants for this motherfucker?
That's what I was going to say. You know all grandmas know how to sew back then.
I was going to say, this grandma can sew some pants for this motherfucker. Let's turn that skirt into some pants. Come on.
I agree. Except what if it's pink with like daisies?
Well, hey, we're not worried about the color here. Worried about being pants or a skirt.
It was reported that Lottie was a strict disciplinarian who had little patience for her children and was verbally abusive towards Wallace, continually scrutinizing him for the tiniest of mistakes. His first taste of hell would come at the age of 3 when he was being potty trained. If he had an accident in his trousers, he was berated by his mother. The chastisement instilled such a terror in Wallace that he had accidents often and would try to hide his mistakes by hiding his soiled trousers. Fucking sad.
Well, how does that work, though? Like, eventually, I mean, if you're that poor, you don't have, like, a ton of trousers to...
That's
like,
why you're probably wearing your sister's dresses
yeah.
now.
I'm just saying, like, that's interesting. I mean, obviously, he's going to get caught because he only got so many trousers, you know?
Agreed. According to Thought.com, when Lottie felt her children needed to be disciplined and she was too tired to do so it herself, she often made Wallace and his sister get a switch from the yard and whip each other. Later in 1996, when Wallace was interviewed in jail by a social worker, he recalled how painful it was to have to hurt his sister, worse than being on the receiving end of it.
Yeah, that's really messing with your psyche.
Yeah, it is. Despite being raised in an unstable home, as a teen, Wallace was popular amongst his peers at the Barnwell High School, where he was elected to the student council and became part of the cheerleading team, being the only boy, after his mother had forbid him to play football. Academically, Wallace made average grades. After graduating high school in 1983, he attended one semester of college at South Carolina State, as well as one semester at a technical college. Now, during this time, he was working as a disc jockey for a local Barnwell radio station, which was short-lived after he was fired for stealing music records.
So funny. Good Lord.
In 1985, at the age of 20, Wallace joined the United States Naval Reserve and, from all accounts, did what he was asked to do and did it quite well. That same year, he married a high school classmate, Moretta Brabham, and became a stepfather to Moretta's daughter. However, not long after Wallace was married, he began using drugs, with his poison of choice being crack cocaine. That's terrible. It's so bad.
Yeah, and we have talked about crack before on our podcast, but I'll go a little bit more into it. So crack cocaine is really, I mean, I've seen a lot of different drug abuse throughout my time being a probation officer and being in law enforcement in general. And I will tell you, there's something about crack cocaine. And I know why. And it's because of the way that it's delivered into the body and into the nervous system and into the bloodstream. And it's a very quick high. And it's probably one of the quickest highs you can get outside of heroin. And it's because of the way that it's ingested. It's smoked, right? So it goes directly into your lungs. It bypasses everything else and goes directly into your brain and into your blood. Whereas an injection still has to go through the entire circulatory system to get to your brain and actually make you high. The lungs go from lungs upwards to your brain, done, you're high. And I think that's why crack cocaine becomes so majorly addictive and just really just grabs a hold of people and just can't let them go.
I would agree with that. In order to pay for his newly found drug habit, Wallace began burglarizing homes and businesses. In 1987, while stationed in Washington State, he was served warrants for robberies that had occurred in the Seattle metro area. Now, a little side note, I could not find anything about what became of these charges.
Yeah, I saw that in your notes, and that was interesting, and I couldn't find anything. But, I mean, it's still, that's a long time ago, so you're still dealing with a lot of stuff that wasn't really recorded very well throughout the internets or interwebs.
According to A&E True Crime, that same year, Wallace committed his first rape, that of a 16-year-old girl in Seattle, but was never arrested for the crime. In January of 1988, Wallace was arrested for breaking into a hardware store and later pleaded guilty to a charge of second-degree burglary. The judge sentenced him to 2 years of supervised probation, but according to his probation officer, Patrick Seberg, Wallace blew off most of his mandatory meetings. Wouldn't that be like a revoke for probation?
If they kept up with it the way they should. Now, what I will tell you is that when probation and stuff came around and parole, there were a lot of mishaps with how to run this system. It's difficult because you're talking about putting somebody on being watched, but it's not a 24-hour babysitting service. So even though people are on probation and on parole, parole, their probation officer and their parole officer are not sitting on them 24/7. They're not monitoring them like that. And even if they have a monitor on them that does monitor them 24/7, those reports are only being checked when the probation officer or the parole officer are in their offices, not at night. And sometimes they are. I mean, sometimes they can get alerts at night, but you're talking about once the alert happens and getting with a judge, trying to find them. You're not finding a judge at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock at midnight, waking them up to deal with the probation. They'll say, wait till in the morning. So a lot of times that's what happens. And I think the misconception is that these guys are being watched 24/7, and they're just not. And so things are going to happen.
Okay.
And our society, along with our government, cannot afford to pay somebody to be a 24-hour watch on all these people.
Well, that's true, too. Wallace would jump from rape to murder, committing his first killing on March 8, 1990, in Barnwell, South Carolina. 18-year-old Tashonda Bethia, a Barnwell High School student, was sexually assaulted and then strangled to death, with her body being dumped into a local lake and not discovered until several weeks later. Wallace was questioned by the police regarding her disappearance and death, but was never formally charged with her murder. He was also questioned about the attempted rape of a 16-year-old Barnwell girl, but he was never charged with that either.
I feel like there's some shitty police work going on.
Well, it's all about what you can prove. And remember, we're still in the early 90s, so we're in the infancy ages of DNA and that kind of stuff. So, you know, what you can prove and what you know are two very different things.
In February of 1991, Wallace broke into his old high school and the radio station where he once worked. He stole video and recording equipment and was caught trying to pawn them.
Also here, found nothing of charges on this.
Yeah.
In 1992, Wallace was arrested again for breaking and entering. Now, during this time, his criminal activity had come to light with the Navy, but due to his near-perfect service record, he managed to get an honorable discharge that same year. Now, his discharge was pretty much forced by the Navy.
Go to the brink.
Pretty much.
By this time, his marriage to Moretta had fallen apart, and Wallace relocated to Charlotte, North Carolina. He found jobs at several fast food restaurants in East Charlotte before becoming a manager at a Taco Bell near the now-defunct Eastland Mall. Once settled in Charlotte, Wallace's lust for killing would run rampant.
I want you to remember, too, here as we go through these victims and start talking about them, I really want our listeners to pay attention to who they were, what they were, because I'm going to talk a little bit more about this and why his methodology and why his typology with his victims were the way they were, in my opinion, at the end of this.
Okay. In May of 1992, Wallace picked up 33-year-old Sharon Nance, a convicted drug dealer and known prostitute. Per Wallace, when Sharon had demanded money for her services, he beat her to death and then dropped her body by the railroad tracks. Several days later, Sharon Nance's body was discovered.
That's a horrible way to be described.
Yeah, it is. Just 1 month later, in June of 1992, Wallace raped and then strangled 20-year-old college student Caroline Love to death at her apartment. He then dumped her body in a wooded area of Charlotte. Now, Caroline Love actually knew Wallace. She was Sadie McKnight's roommate, who just so happened to be Wallace's girlfriend.
There you go.
Yep. How this took the police so damn long to figure this out, It's crazy to me.
Yep, it is very crazy.
At the time of Caroline's death, she was working at Bojangles Restaurant in Charlotte. The manager of the restaurant, Jeffrey Ellis, contacted Caroline's sister, Kathy Love, after Caroline had not reported to work for a couple of days, and asked Kathy if she could check on her sister. Kathy, being concerned about her sister, went to Caroline's apartment. Not finding Caroline at home or evidence of foul play, Kathy left a note relaying Caroline's boss and her own concern. Kathy then contacted Caroline's roommate, Sadie McKnight, to see if she had any idea where her sister could be. Sadie, too, expressed that she had become concerned about Caroline's whereabouts, as it was unlike her to go more than 48 hours without communicating with her. Strangely enough, not only did Kathy and Sadie report Caroline as a missing person to the police, but so did Wallace.
Well, of course. I mean, it's not no fun unless the people know that she's dead. It doesn't Absolutely. Feed the need. Now, I will say, I just want to give a big shout out to Bojangles. If you've never been to a Bojangles, listeners, and you're in the East Coast and you're around the Carolinas, Bojangles, oh my God, they have the best biscuits. They have a chicken fried steak biscuit and a chicken fried chicken biscuit. And I'm going to tell you right now, it is the best top of the line food hangover, kill it, awesome. I mean, Bojangles, I love you.
Investigator Anthony Rice questioned the Bojangles manager and learned that the last time he had seen Caroline was when she left work on the evening of June 15th. She had asked if she could trade a $10 bill for a roll of quarters so she could do a load of laundry when she got home. Her cousin, Robert Ross, who drove her back to her place that night, said he saw her go into her foyer and that she had seemed neither sidetracked nor nervous. So somebody was there waiting for her, yep. I would assume.
Yes, that's what I would assume too.
During the police's search of Caroline's apartment, they became suspicious. It bore the resemblance of a struggle. The furniture seemed to be slightly repositioned as if shoved aside during a fight. The sheets from Caroline's bed were removed and were not in the laundry hamper, which was full. Investigator Rice determined that Caroline had never done the laundry as she had planned and that the roll of quarters she purchased from her workplace was not in the apartment.
Bingo! Because he was already waiting there for her.
Yep. Charlotte police continued to search for Caroline Love, but every lead met with another dead end. She was filed as a missing person and became one of the many unsolved cases. It would almost be 2 years later, in March of 1994, before Caroline Love's remains were discovered. That's so fucking terrible.
Very terrible.
8 months after Caroline Love's murder, Wallace struck again, strangling to death 20-year-old Shauna Hawk. Shauna, who was a college student, had been strangled to death at her home after first being raped. Mm. Just like with Caroline Love, Wallace had known Shauna. She had worked at Taco Bell, where Wallace was her supervisor.
Yeah, of course.
And still, we're not going to match these up.
On the evening of February 19th, 1993, Shauna's mother, Sylvia Sumter, came home from work prepared to make dinner for herself and her daughter. Sylvia, not finding her daughter at home, began wondering where she was, as Shauna should have already made it home from Piedmont Central Community College. Sylvia would then notice that Shauna's coat and purse were in the dining room. Being confused by what she found, Sylvia called Shauna's boyfriend, Daryl Kirkpatrick, and was informed that he had not seen Shauna all day. Sylvia then called the Taco Bell that her daughter worked at part-time and learned that she was not at work and was not on the evening schedule. When Shauna's boyfriend, Daryl, received another frantic phone call from his girlfriend's mother, he quickly made his way to their house. Once Daryl arrived at the home, he quickly began rummaging through the house, hoping to find a clue as to where Shauna might have gone. Daryl eventually made his way into the downstairs bathroom, where he noticed that the carpet was soaked and that the shower curtain was not tucked in place. Yanking the shower curtain back, Daryl discovered Shauna's naked body in a tub full of water, her head sunken below the surface, and her eyes staring lifelessly upwards.
Oh, God. What a terrible thing.
God, could you imagine finding your boyfriend and girlfriend like that? Like, that would be terrible.
He is a very sexual-driven serial killer. And disregarding them and killing them, probably in the act, during, or after, or shortly after, is what feeds the need for him.
I would agree with that. Shauna was pronounced dead at the hospital. Her skull had suffered lacerations and bruising caused by a blow from a dull and heavy object, but the blow did not kill her. Forensic pathologist James M. Sullivan, who performed the autopsy, determined that Shauna had been strangled to death. He noted hemorrhaging in the conjunctiva, which is the lining of the eyes, the face, the lips, and across the voice box, all trademarks of a ligature strangulation.
Yeah. So she was strangled with something for sure. And that's what happens, right? Because you're starving all those areas of oxygen. So they're literally going to burst and they're going to look and search for any kind of oxygen they can get through the strangulation. That's why you see the kind of injuries you see here.
According to Dr. Sullivan, a ligature is a cord or a band or something that is made into a cord or a band, then circles the neck and is used to forcibly compress the neck.
But he doesn't leave it there. That's what's interesting to me.
No, he does.
He does?
On most of them, he does.
But well, on
there's
her.
A couple, not on her, but on a couple of them, he does.
Yeah, I know on some of them he does, but on this girl, he doesn't.
No, he doesn't.
He takes it with him.
He takes it with, yes, you're right. He also puts her in a bathtub.
Yes, with water to try to make it look like she drowned. So now you can see where he's coming back into his competency at some level of this crime, where he's feeding his sick need, but then he comes back into competency of trying to clean himself up and look like he didn't do nothing wrong.
I would agree with that.
Which also tells me his lack of intelligence, because he doesn't understand how it's going to work with autopsies and that kind of stuff.
Yes, you are correct, Corey.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Shauna's death was ruled as a homicide, and the police were quickly notified. Shauna's co-workers, friends, and classmates were all interviewed, but nevertheless, the police failed to narrow in on a suspect or a motive. According to Sylvia, Shauna's mother, she had once went to a comedy show with Wallace, who came to pick her up at the house, but she was not interested in dating him.
Do you think that might have been retaliation?
No.
No.
I think he was already starting to...
Obsessed that was
bait. Okay. Yeah, he was already starting to bait her, and he was trying to get close with her, and he was trying to see if she was going to be good enough to be his next victim.
Okay. Wallace, whom Sylvia described as intelligent and well-spoken, went to her daughter's wake. What the actual fuck?
I know. That's fucking crazy.
Later, she ran into him at a store and spoke to the press about the encounter, stating, "He leans over to hug me and says, 'I've been wanting to come and see you. I'm so sorry.' He's hugging me and patting me on the back, saying, 'Oh my God, Shauna was the sweetest person ever.'"
You like sick that's, bastard.
Yeah, you sick motherfucker.
Several months later, on June 22, 1993, Wallace found another victim, 24-year-old Audrey Spain, who was also raped and strangled to death.
Audrey, who had been a dependable employee at Taco Bell, had failed to show up for work two nights in a row on June 23rd and June 24th. One of her managers grew concerned after her second no-show and tried to phone Audrey, but kept only getting her answering machine. Audrey's manager then tried calling her sister, but could not reach her. Her manager then decided to drive by Audrey's apartment to check on her himself. Finding that her car was in the parking lot of the apartment building, he ventured to her apartment and knocked on the door several times, but there was no answer. That's pretty good of the manager to go and be like, man, something's wrong. Something's not right.
Yeah, this girl's pretty steady coming into work. She's pretty always here. This is weird. Something's up.
The next morning on June 25th, when Audrey's manager was still unable to reach her or her sister, he made a call to Audrey's apartment building's maintenance man to ask for his help with checking in on Audrey. When the maintenance man entered Audrey's apartment, he found the bedroom door open and what looked like a naked woman sprawled across the bed. He immediately recognized the body as Audrey's, even with her eyes almost bulging out of their sockets.
Wow. Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. We're going to get to it in a minute.
Wrapped around her neck were articles of clothing of what looked like a t-shirt and a bra, tied together and knotted at her Adam's apple to cut off her air. Medical examiners concurred that she had been both strangled and raped.
Yeah. I mean, the amount of aggression that he had, this is where I really think the strangulation probably took place during the rape. It was something that fed his need. But the amount of strangulation to make her eyes bulge out of her head, I mean, that's intense.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Well, not even that, but man, strangling, like we've talked about before, and like you've stated, it's such an intimate act.
It's a very intimate act. It is something that, and we're going to get into that at the end of this when we get done with all the victims and why this is his need. This is his MO, why he does it this way. We're going to get into that shortly when we get to the end of this. But yeah, a very intimate kind of way to kill somebody.
Would fucking agree. So far, we have one missing person and two nearly identical strangulations occurring only months apart. Unfortunately, no witnesses came forth to report suspicious characters hanging about at the advent of each crime, and the investigations of Caroline Love, Shauna Hawk, and Audrey Spain faded into the background as police were forced to take on other crimes occurring across Charlotte. Now, during 1993, the police in Charlotte were trying to battle mixed criminal activity while being understaffed and overworked. There were only 7 full-time investigators on roll call at the time. That's crazy. Charlotte's a big city, too.
But that's budget. That's government. That's when you have to get more money from taxpayers to do what you need to do. It's hard.
I agree. According to the FBI's Uniform Crime Reporting Program, the city of Charlotte's stats for 1993 indicate more than 51,000 incidences of crime, 9,102 of those falling under the description of violent. Broken down, they cite 87 murders, 350 rapes, 2,713 robberies, and 5,952 assaults. That's fucking crazy.
That's a huge demographic of statistics.
Just a few weeks later, on August 9th, 1993, Wallace raped and strangled to death 19-year-old Valencia Jumper, a friend of his sister's. Valencia was an ambitious college student who had recently relocated from Columbia, South Carolina, and worked at Food Lion Groceries as well as a clothing shop to help pay for her tuition. On that deadly night of August 9th, Valencia's visiting friend, Zachary Douglas, had smelled something burning as he neared Valencia's apartment doorway. He then saw fragments of black smoke coming from the door's threshold. Finding Valencia's door bolted, Zachary found another tenant of the building who called the fire department. Firefighters arrived on the scene in no time and axed the door down. Once inside Valencia's small apartment, firefighter Dennis Arney saw that the blaze, which had spread throughout the apartment, had begun on the kitchen stove, where a pot of something had been left over a lit gas burner. The flames had reached a connecting bedroom, where it appeared Valencia had fallen asleep on her bed. She was also found severely burned. Which makes me think, I don't know. Okay, we're going to get to it.
Okay.
I'm sorry, because the medical examiner is a fucking idiot, I feel like.
Let's get into it.
Okay. The next day, the medical examiner looked over her charred remains and would wrongly rule Valencia Jumper's death due to carbon monoxide poisoning. It would not be until Wallace was caught and admitted to murdering Valencia that her body was re-examined.
Yeah, re-examined. So this is something that, to me, this medical examiner was like, he's already, this is closed cut, just go, go, go. Let's get done with it without looking a little deeper into what was going on with her and why and what happened. And really doing a thorough job. I do agree with you that the medical examiner really lacked thoroughness in his investigation of this crime.
And I think it has to do with the demographic of who she was.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not going to lie, but I do.
You're
I
in a very deep-seated racial area of the time.
Yep.
So I would have to agree with you on that 100%.
A few days after Valencia Jumper's murder, Wallace and his sister went to her funeral, and just 5 weeks later, he would claim another life.
Fucking crazy how sometimes they like to go to their victims' wakes or like search parties.
It's
and
a
stuff.
Reliving moment for them.
I bet
right?
it is.
Like I said, it's hard for us people who are do not think the way of these types of people to understand what they're thinking. But it is very much a serving of need. Like me, I'm a huge ice cream fan. And so it serves my need to eat ice cream. Like I have a deep-seated need to feed myself ice cream. And no matter what diet I ever try to go on, I cannot get away from ice cream. It's like, it's my thing. So it's deep, deep kind of need that is fed through something that's not so great for me, right? And that's what's happening here. It's just a deep-seated need. And I'm not trying to say and you know, minimize this man and what he did by any means, but I'm trying to help our listeners understand kind of the point of feeding it. If you have something that, an addiction, cigarettes, drugs, alcohol, you know, anything like that, that you become addicted to and you have to feed that need. You feel that strong pulling towards it. That's what's happening here with him.
Very well explained.
Yeah.
On September 15th, 1993, 20-year-old Michelle Stinson, a struggling college student and a mother of two, was killed in a manner with a major variation from the other murdered females. While Michelle was strangled like the others, she was also stabbed with a kitchen knife that had been shoved through her back. Michelle's lifeless body was found in the kitchen by her two young sons, 1 3 and the other only just a year old, who had neither seen nor heard her assailant. Michelle's oldest son ran for help to a friend, James May, telling him that his mother was sleeping on the floor.
Ugh. So terrible.
Mm. Mays hurried over to discover Michelle lying cold in a pool of blood. Her telephone had been ripped out from the wall. Just like with the other women, Michelle had known Wallace. The two had met at Taco Bell, where he was a manager.
Mm. I guess this is why he's called the Taco Bell Killer.
There you go.
The autopsy revealed that the blade had penetrated the upper side of Michelle's back below the shoulder blade and had caused mortal wounds to her heart and lungs. The autopsy also showed that she had been raped and then strangled with a ligature. However, this time, the strangling occurred after she had died from the knife wounds.
Yeah, he wanted to make sure she was dead. And, you know, this is the worst thing of all. So he incapacitates them with either hitting him on the head with something, trying to incapacitate so he can do what he needs to do, and then kills him. And that's what happened here. He basically took whatever he could, which as soon as he got an opening into the house, probably waiting outside, as soon as he got an opening into the house with her, he got in there, he grabbed whatever he could to incapacitate her and wanted to make sure she was dead with the strangling. But I'm going to get into why I think the strangling is also so significant.
Okay.
As the police continued to question relatives and friends, neighbors, and cohorts of the murdered women, they kept drawing blanks, even though the killings were starting to appear as maybe the handiwork of one man whose MO was raping women and then strangling them, which all took place within a 5-mile radius of East Charlotte.
And yet we're still not putting the pieces together.
Oh, they're starting to sniff, but no bingos haven't made yet.
Nope.
The black community in Charlotte, whose area where the homicides were occurring, began to demand answers from the police and had interpreted the police department's no-show results as something else, a laissez-faire attitude by local law enforcement and politicians because it was black women being raped and murdered. In fact, most local newspapers had not reported on the murders of the black women in their community. That's fucking horrific.
But so telling of the times.
Yeah. And we're not talking long ago. We're talking about the 90s, people.
Yeah, but I mean, you look what happened in the 90s when it came to race.
That's true.
And racism.
Yeah, you have a lot of riots going on. You have Rodney King.
You got a lot of shit going on.
I forget how bad
it was
race
back
riots
then. Yeah.
were back then.
And how, to me, that's when it really came to a pinnacle point of pushing us into the future now that we're at.
I would agree with that.
Now, in defense, City Hall vowed that they were doing the best they could, that the city's patrolmen were working night and day to solve the rash of murders, and that patrol cars were stopping any and all suspicious characters. At an emergency press conference, the department committed to results and assured the people that the investigations would continue. It would be several months later before Wallace would strike again. On February 4th, 1994, Wallace was arrested for shoplifting, but police had still not made the connection between him and the murders.
Because they're fucking idiots.
Well,
come on, Corey. They're fucking idiots at this point.
They're definitely in the struggle bus on this for sure. I will give you that.
I don't think they're doing a very good job.
Yeah, they're not the forefront of their investigations.
Yes.
But again, the time, the area, the demographics of where you're at are all playing key roles into why, in my opinion, these investigators just really didn't give a fuck.
I would agree with that. On February 20th, 1994, Wallace strangled to death 25-year-old Vanessa Mack, a mother of two in her apartment. Wallace had also known Vanessa as well. The two had worked together at Taco Bell.
He has a lot of victims from his work. And they can't piece it together?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's, to me, that's one of the big, we'll get to that mistake. But yeah, there's issues there.
On that fateful Sunday, Vanessa's mother, Barbara, had come to pick up her grandchild as she did every Sunday so that Vanessa could go to her other job at the Carolinas Medical Center, and it arrived a little earlier than usual. It wasn't quite 6 a.m. yet. Surprised at finding her daughter's front door ajar, Barbara called out, expecting to hear her daughter or grandchildren, but she was only answered with quietness. Stepping into the foyer, Barbara saw Vanessa's four-month-old child asleep on the sofa, still in her play clothes from the day before, but Vanessa was nowhere to be seen. When Barbara did a double take at the bed in Vanessa's bedroom, she realized that the gray bundle of covers was not a bundle at all, but her daughter thrown partially dressed in a misshapen position across the mattress with something wrapped around her throat, which looked like a pillowcase. Vanessa's skin tone was a dull gray, and her skin had become cold to the touch. Barbara then raced to another tenant's apartment and used his phone to call the police. Jeff Baumgartner was the first patrolman to arrive on the scene. With just one glance at the crime scene, he knew that the same killer had struck again. So at least I guess they're starting to piece together. It's the same person.
Right. They're starting to get the MO down.
During this time, Charlotte detectives sought the assistance of the Federal Bureau of Investigation to define the type of murder or murderers they were looking for. According to North Carolina University professor of criminal justice, Charisse Costin, whose classes have studied the complexities of the case, the FBI failed to slot the strangulations as those of a serial killer, a call that would prove to be erroneous. Although the Bureau missed its mark in the case, some would say it should not be judged harshly. According to a 1994 Associated Press article, the black man who was finally arrested for the crimes did not fit the niche at all. Most serial killers are white men who kill strangers. This killer was a black man who knew his victims. I still feel like they should have done a better job on this.
Well, and it just shows, I mean, I hate to keep circling back to this, but it just really shows the mentality of the time. I mean, even at the FBI level, I mean, they knew that black men were capable of serial killing. You'd already had several black men that were involved in serial killing. This wasn't above it. So while you say you can't really take and blame, I do blame you. You did a shitty job on this one, FBI.
I would agree with that.
With the profiling.
Yep.
I mean, it obviously, we're going to get into that too, but it obviously was pretty clear of what was going on here and what type of typology you should put into it.
Fucking agree. During the second week of March 1994, the murder cases began to crack open. There would be three more murders in 3 days, and as 29-year-old Henry Lewis Wallace's lust for blood became a need to feed, he grew careless. The precautions he had previously taken to hide himself, spacing out the murders, wiping off fingerprints, even bathing some of his victims, were left to the wayside as he went on his killing spree. On March 7, 1994, 24-year-old Betty Bauckham did not report to work at Bojangles Restaurant, where she served as an assistant manager. Because it was the same restaurant on Central Avenue where Caroline Love had worked before she had disappeared without a trace, and the fact that Betty, by all accounts, was a dependable employee, her manager, Jeffrey Ellis, became cautious, calling Betty at her home but got no answer. Throughout the night, Jeffrey figured Betty might show up for her shift with a reasonable explanation, but she never showed. The next day, Betty was scheduled to work again, but when she did not show up for her shift once more, her manager Ellis called the Charlotte police. Police officer Gregory Norwood responded to the call and was able to obtain access into Betty's apartment through the building's maintenance man. Once inside her apartment, Officer Norwood discovered Betty fully clothed, face down on her mattress, strangled to death by a towel twisted into a noose around her neck. She was cold to the touch, having been dead for more than 24 hours. However, unlike other murders of the past victims' residences, which reflected only minor, if any, physical signs of disturbance, Betty's apartment had been noticeably looted. A bare entertainment center and cable wires leading to nowhere alerted officers that a TV and a VCR were missing. Officers also discovered that Betty's car, an aqua-colored Pulsar, was gone from the building's parking lot. Police squads were quickly put on alert to look out for the aqua-colored Pulsar that might be pursuing the streets of Charlotte. Simultaneously, detectives checked the local pawn shops to see if anyone had tried to hawk stolen items for cash.
Well, I feel like they're finally doing something.
Yeah, me too.
Once again, Wallace had known Betty. His girlfriend and Betty were co-workers at the Bojangles restaurant.
And we're still not putting this together.
We're still not putting it together.
Now, terrifyingly enough, that same day while police were in the midst of investigating the newly found murdered Betty, a police headquarters dispatcher summoned a patrol officer to the apartment of 18-year-old Brandy Henderson, whose boyfriend had just found her dead. When the police arrived, they realized it was the same apartment complex where Betty Baucom had just been found strangled to death.
Dun, 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 dun.
Brandy, who was a high school student, lived in the apartment with her boyfriend, Vernest Lamar Woods, and their infant son. On that deadly late evening of March 8, 1994, Vernest had returned home from working his night shift to find the apartment in a complete disarray, and his girlfriend, Brandy, dead in their bed with towels wrapped around her neck, and her face was a bluish tone. Their 10-month-old son, T.W., was found in his bedroom with a pair of shorts wrapped around his neck, barely breathing. A court summary of the incident reads, Vernest Woods immediately ran to T.W. to remove a pair of shorts which were tied tightly around his neck. Vernest then called 911, moved Brandy's body from the bed to the floor, and began administering CPR with instructions from the 911 operator. When the police officers arrived, it was clear Brandy was dead. An ambulance rushed little T.W. to the Carolinas Medical Center, where at first doctors feared the asphyxiation he suffered might have caused brain damage. Luckily, though, the child revived and tests indicated that he would recover without permanent injury. Oh. He's so fucking lucky.
So lucky.
Autopsy reports indicated that Brandy Henderson had been violently raped before she was strangled to death, and it was later discovered that Wallace had violently raped Brandy while she was holding her infant son.
Ugh.
That's fucking horrible.
God, that is so bad.
It makes me sick to my stomach.
Yeah. I mean, this guy is a sick fuck for sure. There's no other way to describe him.
And I'm not surprised he got the death penalty.
I can't believe they haven't killed him yet.
I know. Like with Betty Baucom's crime scene, items in Brandy and Vanessa's apartment had been stolen, as well as, once again, the victim knew her assailant. Wallace was a friend of Brandy's boyfriend, Vernest Woods. In fact, Vernest had told the police that Wallace was prone to visit Brandy while he was at work. And we're not putting pieces together?
I know, right?
He's giving you a suspect right there.
They're still missing the point.
Yep. The police department beefed up their patrol of East Charlotte, but nevertheless, Wallace managed to evade the police and struck again. 35-year-old Deborah Ann Slaughter was stabbed 38 times in the stomach and chest before she was strangled to death. Just like with the other victims, Deborah had known her killer. Deborah had been a co-worker of Wallace's girlfriend, Sadie McKnight. It would be a few days before Deborah's body was discovered.
I mean, we got two places where people are just popping up dead from.
Just killing me here. Okay, can I just say how this is killing me? Because you're talking about you're beefing up patrols. Like, what, you think you're just driving around the city and hope to catch them? I mean, fuck, come on. And it's so telling of the times, though, and the way that they approached crime back then and cases back then to the way they do now. It was just so different.
Agreed.
So lack of knowledge.
Detective Sergeant Gary McFadden, who was leading the investigation, held a meeting to compare notes that he had made during interviews with the victim's acquaintances. What detectives discovered would be eye-opening. They indicated that the girls did not seem to know each other, although some had crossed paths. But when asked to list names of people with whom each victim associated with, all the interviewees mentioned in their list the same name, Henry Lewis Wallace.
Well, why didn't they do this before? I don't understand. What took them so long to get here?
Yep. Both Shauna Hawk and Audrey Spain had at one time worked at Taco Bell for the same manager, Henry Wallace. Valencia Jumper was a good friend of Wallace's sister, Yvonne. Michelle Stinson would often eat at Taco Bell and chat with Wallace. Vanessa Mack was the sister of one of Wallace's girlfriends. And Betty Baucom was also a friend of Wallace's girlfriend. And Brandy Henderson was the girlfriend of one of Wallace's friends, Vernurse Lamar Woods. After this astonishing discovery, Detective McFadden went back to the case of missing person Caroline Love. He would learn that Caroline had also known Wallace as well. She had been the roommate of Sadie McKnight, his girlfriend, whom Wallace visited regularly. When Detective McFadden pulled Wallace's rap sheet, he was surprised to find that, as he recalls, an outstanding warrant was already out for him for having failed to come to court on a recent larceny charge.
Oh my gosh.
You fucking idiot.
Idiot.
Police then approached Wallace's girlfriend, Sadie McKnight, who was very taken back by the news that her boyfriend was suspected of being the Charlotte Strangler. Really, were you?
Yeah, were you really? Come on.
However, the more Sadie thought about it, the more sense it made. During the relationship, Wallace had been giving Sadie presents such as rings and necklaces that sometimes seemed to be very familiar, and would soon realize that she had been wearing dead friend's jewelry.
Oh my gosh. Can you imagine? Like, that's fucked up.
It is so fucked up.
I mean, can you just imagine? Like, what the fuck?
Nope. Mm-mm. Just a few days later, the evidence that the Charlotte detectives needed was finally discovered. Betty Baucom's Pulsar was located, abandoned across town in a shopping center's parking lot. Swipes of latent fingerprints found on the trunk lid would match that of Henry Wallace's.
Bingo!
Yep. Police staked out Wallace's residence at the Glen Hollow Apartments on North Sharon Amity Road throughout the evening on March 11, 1994, and the following day, March 12. When Wallace had not shown, officers Gil Alred and Sid Wright tracked him down at a friend's house where he was cuffed at approximately 5 p.m. on March 12, 1994. According to the arrest report, Wallace was sober, very calm, and collected, surrendered without a fight, and seemed a little wrinkled.
What?
A little wrinkled? What the fuck? Okay, listeners, come on. Y'all got to tell us what the hell that means. I don't understand that saying.
Disarray.
Like a little wrinkled? Like, is that like a way of saying like you didn't look good or like you looked a little disheveled or what?
I think so.
A little wrinkled.
Following their supervisor's orders, the patrolmen took Wallace not to the customary intake center, but to the Law Enforcement Center, or the LEC, where a small group of detectives were waiting to question him. Now, while detectives were waiting at the LEC to question their suspect, the body of Deborah Ann Slaughter was found. Deborah had been raped, beaten, stabbed, and strangled to death. During her autopsy, a white linen was found shoved down her windpipe. What the actual fuck?
Oh, she was a screamer.
That's what I was thinking.
He was trying to quiet her.
Back at the LEC, Wallace was asked by detectives if he knew why he was there, and at first he alluded only to the larceny charge. However, after several hours of being questioned, Wallace eventually confessed to killing all nine of the Charlotte women, Carolina Love, Shauna Hawk, Audrey Spain, Valencia Jumper, Michelle Stinson, Vanessa Mack, Betty Baucom, Brandy Henderson, and less than 48 hours before he was arrested, Deborah Slaughter. Wallace also admitted to murdering a prostitute whose name he never knew and whose body he concealed in a remote area not far from where he had dumped Caroline Love's body. And the police would actually go out there and find the bodies. This is how they're discovered.
Yikes.
At approximately 10 p.m. on March 12, 1994, after the initial interrogation, Wallace was read his Miranda rights and then asked if he would agree to a taping his confession. According to all reports, in no way was he coerced to do so. Wallace agreed, telling officers, "I feel like a big burden has been lifted." While being taped, Wallace led detectives through many hours of sickening and disturbing details of his crimes. He described his thoughts as he killed the women, remembering their final words and actions, even their agony when he applied what he called the Boston Henry Wallace choke on them to render them powerless.
Wow.
Sick fuck. Even though he did rob some of his victims, this was not motive for the murders, but rather that of a sinister sexual nature. It was how he fulfilled his sexual fantasies of power and control. Wallace also stated that he started having violent fantasies of dominating women after he witnessed a gang rape at the age of 8, and at 16, he had attempted to rape a friend's younger sister. Eventually, he started having rough sex with sex workers.
Wow.
I think he's fucked up from an early age.
Yeah.
And I think that's from his mom.
Mm-hmm. We'll get into that.
At one point, an investigator told Wallace that he did not seem to be a bad man by nature and asked him if he thought he might be schizophrenic. No, Wallace answered, there's only one Henry.
A bad Henry?
Well, at least he knows.
After Wallace's tape confession ended, Inspector Sanders asked him, "Why have you told us what you have told us?" Wallace responded, "I wanted to tell the story for a long time. If I wouldn't have told you, if I wouldn't have stopped, the killings would have continued, and probably I would have killed myself as well. I've tried many times, but was unsuccessful." And here, is he tried many times to stop killing, or is he tried many times to kill himself?
Kill himself.
If somebody really wants to kill themselves, Corey, and you know it, they kill themselves.
Yeah.
So you're calling out for help.
We're going to get into that.
Detective McFadden said Wallace would form a friendship or establish a trust with his victims before he would kill them, stating, "The victims felt comfortable with him because he portrayed himself as the big brother, as the good friend. Henry was like the perfect human predator. He walked into their lives knowing that at some point he's going to take their life." Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would in a heartbeat.
Wallace's killings broke up families, stole daughters and sisters from their loved ones, and left 7 children without their mothers. That's a lot of children.
Yep, a lot of children.
On April 4th, 1994, Wallace was officially indicted with 9 counts of murder, as well as a slew of other charges, including various counts of first and second degree rape, various counts of first and second degree sexual offense, various counts of assault with a deadly weapon, assault on a child under the age of 12, and several counts of robbery with a dangerous weapon. Damn, you racked up the charges
Jesus
there.
Jesus Christ, it's a lot of them.
Wallace's trial for murder, which took place at the Mecklenburg County Superior Courthouse, lasted nearly 4 months. That's a long time.
Very long time.
Beginning in September of 1996 and ending in late January of 1997. Lead prosecution was Ann Tompkins, fresh off her victory from sending high-profile child killer Fred Caufrey to prison for life. Wallace's public defender was led by Isabel Scott Day. According to a social profile done on Henry Louis Wallace in preparation for his trial, his problems stemmed from a dysfunctional upbringing. Wallace's mother had a hard life, and having 2 children out of wedlock by a married high school teacher who then returned to his wife did not help.
Okay, so this is where we're going to get into it, about, to me, why he is the way he is. So let's start back at the beginning. What do we know about his mom? What do we know about him? We know he was raised in a single household with a single mom. We know that his mother was hardworking to keep the family afloat. We know that the discipline of his younger sister was put on him to discipline and whip her by his mother. And we know that he saw things that young age that taught him more of a sinister sexual appetite than anything else. So when you start to combine those things and you look at his victims, hardworking African-American black women who he picked out, he friended, and then did the sinister acts to, which forms the way his mother was and why his mother, to me, is the leading cause of who he is and what happens and what he does. And there's so many studies and stuff out there about sex offenders and that kind of stuff and sexual predators and serial killers and how much the mother-son dynamic has to play that role of why they do what they do, especially when you have a mother who doesn't so much have her nurturing side to her as she does her evil, you know, sadistic punishment side to her. And that's what you see happening here. So his first taste of sex was watching a woman be gang raped. So right away, his level of expectations and sex is going to have to be violent because that's all he knows, right? And then on top of that, now you have a dominating female who's hardworking, who may not be giving the time and comfort to the children that she should, is now his prime target because that's getting back at his mom. So there's so much psychology that goes into why he did what he did, but it definitely stems from his mother and the way he was brought up.
Carmeta V. Alvarez, a certified social worker who interviewed Wallace and his family for his trial's defense team, stated that Wallace's mother sought to control her son through violence, emotional abuse, and other inappropriate means.
Yeah, exactly. That's how he was introduced to the world he was introduced to.
Yes.
So, of course, that's how he acts out. I know I reference movies all the time in this, but you can go back to anybody who's seen the 50 Shades of Grey movies and that kind of stuff, and how his mother and what happened to him played a role in what he did to, you know,
feed his sexual appetite.
Yep. Same thing's going on here.
I would agree with that. Which is really fucked up when you think about it.
Very fucked up. And it makes you, as a mom of a boy, you're like, fuck, I hope I'm not fucking this guy up.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was saying. I was like, you might be too strict on my boys sometimes.
Well, it's not so much too strict. It's more of a lack of nurturing that they don't get, that they need.
And more of a dominating.
Where fathers teach their daughters how to be treated by a man, mothers teach their sons how to treat women. You know what I mean? And so if I'm domineering and I'm mean, and I'm very abusive towards my son, then that's how he believes women should be treated. And fathers have effect on it too. Don't get me wrong. I mean, you know, when you go into the psychological part of, you know, men who abuse their wives by hitting them and, you know, emotionally abusing them, that kind of stuff. And sons see that. It also plays a role into their psyche. But the role of the psyche to me that it plays into is that it teaches them that women are weaker. It allows that dominating side of a male ego to come out in ways. But for mothers, you really do teach their sons how to treat women. And I say that because if you're nurturing and you're loving, and you can still be strict, you can still be, you know, expect them and hold them to higher standards, but be loving towards them when they need to be loved and cared for is important to how they view their domination over women.
Wallace's state-appointed psychiatrist during his trial told jurors of a mother who would sometimes force her son and daughter to beat each other with a switch. The psychiatrist also stated that Wallace's mother and sister would dress him up as a little girl and parade him around the neighborhood, and that as a young child, he witnessed a gang rape.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think he's going to like being paraded around as a little girl.
Nope, I think that definitely hurt his ego.
Yep.
Despite this, the jury was unmoved, as the prosecution made such an impression with its long line of official witnesses who talked about the latent prints found on Betty Bakken's vehicle and Wallace's tape confession, in which he recalled Brandy Henderson's 10-month-old boy who was almost strangled to death, and who described in detail the ghastly expressions on the dead girls' faces.
Yeah. I mean, you can put lipstick on a pig, but at the end of the day, it's still a fucking pig. This is somebody who doesn't deserve to walk among society ever again.
I would agree. Period.
What he did to his victims and the women in these crimes is just horrific and unexplainable. So yeah, the death penalty is definitely where he belongs, and hopefully sooner than later at this point, because we're working on like almost 30 years now he's been on death row. If there's anybody that deserves it, he's one of them. He's one of them, for sure.
On January 7th, 1997, 12 jurors found Henry Wallace guilty of 9 counts of first-degree murder, each on the basis of malice, premeditation, and deliberation. 3 weeks later, on January 29th, the jury ruled that Wallace should pay for his crimes with his life. Presiding Judge Robert Johnston's declaration of 9 death sentences included in the punishment penalties for rape and the multiplicity of other charges for which he was convicted. In a jailhouse interview, Wallace stated of his crimes, "The only time the police were concerned was when 2 murders occurred on the same day, Bakken and Henderson. All of a sudden, they started seeing connections and things that had happened 20 months ago." I would fucking agree with this.
Yeah, and this is him just taunting the police.
Yes, you fucking idiots. 100%. Look at how smart I am.
Mm-hmm.
During the interview, Wallace said, "Within this shell are 2 people. One person being a chameleon. He will adapt to anything, any environment, any situation. He's very well respected, very well liked person. He almost lures the women in for the other person. Once I touched them, it was over. There was no way I could stop. I think the majority of the victims reminded me of my ex-wife in some way. When the murder and rape was taking place, who I was seeing was her and not the victim." That's fucked up too.
Very fucked up. But I will still say,
it's his mother though.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was his mother that sent him down that road, but I think that his wife left him. I think that fucked with his ego.
Sure, it pissed him off.
And so I think when he was raping the woman, I'm pretty sure he did imagine Moretta.
Because he couldn't punish her. He couldn't punish her the way he wanted to. He couldn't fulfill that part of the fantasy that he needed. That was put there by his mother.
Yep. In 1998, Wallace married a former prison nurse in a ceremony at Central Prison in Raleigh, North Carolina, where he remains on death row today.
Well,
these people that marry these people, I don't understand this. I'm sorry. Like, what the fuck?
I mean, there is such a deep-seated problem there beyond our control, beyond our understanding. I mean,
I don't understand that. It's so fucked up. Okay, Corey, your favorite part, mistakes.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, big mistakes on the, you know, investigators' points, the FBI points. I mean, you know, they just really, really, again, overlooked so much blaring evidence, in my opinion, to really start putting this down as, hey, this is a serial killer. We got a problem on our hands. We needed to start really getting into this. And their answer is, let's put more patrols on the street.
That's not because the answer,
maybe buddy. We'll drive by while he's doing this act, you know? No, I mean, that's just dumb. They should have really done a better job, especially at that point in time with their profiling, with looking into what they're really dealing with and that kind of stuff. So that's definitely the big mistakes and why he wasn't stopped sooner.
I agree with that. Can I also say that I feel like this wasn't that hard of a case to crack had they really done the investigation they should have.
After like the first 4 women, I'd have been like, wait, like, they all worked for the people, same.
Yeah.
Where's my common denominator?
Exactly.
I've got the same MO going on here. Where the fuck's my common denominator with these people? Oh, they all work together for the same guy. There's my common thread. There's my common put together. Maybe I should start thinking about this guy. Maybe I should start looking into this guy. What would they have found? Criminal history. That predicts future criminal history. Criminal activities. So yeah, I mean, just terrible, terrible mistake on their part for not putting this together early. And I think, you know, these women, most of them lost their lives because of that mistake, in my opinion. They could have stopped him a lot earlier if they wanted to.
I agree. Do you think there wasn't as much focus on these murders because they were Black women?
I do. I think the time, the demographic, demographics, the area where it was at, law enforcement where it was at. I definitely think so. They're just disregarding them, you know, and I think you can see that in the investigations why they didn't put anything until the bodies started piling up and they're like, oh, fuck. And now that the Black community's alert and it's starting to get press on this, we're in trouble. We better start really fucking trying to figure this out. And meanwhile, too many women have already lost their lives, period. No matter what their race is. Just I terrible. Agree with that. Like I said, he's an interesting serial killer in the fact that, you know, he had such a sinister need that had to be filled. But at the same time, the typicalness of it, of I need the attention of it, because it does me no good if you don't know what I'm doing, right? It doesn't feed my need of attention that I lacked from my mother. Again, all this stems from the way his mother treated him and the way he was brought up.
I would fucking agree. So mothers, be good to your sons.
I mean, I know it's a fine line, but damn, don't make them whip their younger siblings. That's a fucking terrible idea.
I would agree with that.
I mean...
You're instilling a serial killer.
First of all, my son doesn't have a younger sibling, so I don't have to worry about that. But I don't even make him discipline his dog. Like, if the dog does something wrong, I discipline the dog.
All I'm going to say is my middle child would be so excited if he got to discipline the other ones. He'd be like, yes!
I don't even want to think. I would just see the younger child outside dipping his toes in ice cold water while he sits there in punishment. It would be terrible. In the pool. You sit here with your toes in the pool. 100%. But, you know, I mean, it is important. And I think for our listeners, too, when you look at these kind of cases, you can learn so much from serial killers just on the premise of how they're treated as young children and how much that really has a role and plays a role in how they become an adult. And that's not just serial killers. That's across the board with kids. Talk to any child psychiatrist out there. They're going to tell you that, yes, well, you can have great parents by the outside looking in. Oh, it's a perfect life. You never know what really goes on behind those closed doors.
Agree.
Well, this is a really good one. I hope you guys enjoyed the drink. I hope you enjoyed the case, because this was, to me, a very interesting one for sure.
It was.
Well, as always,
stay strange and unusual.
We'll be back next week with another cocktail and a new tale of sinister minds, their menacing crimes, and mistakes they left behind. Thanks for listening. Please don't forget to subscribe and download us on Spotify, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite show.
Want the recipe to try Corey's sinister cocktail from today's episode? Or have any constructive feedback or true crime stories you would like to hear us cover? Or even sinister cocktail recipes for us to try? Email us at sinistercrimesandcocktails@gmail.com. Visit our website, www.sinistercrimesandcocktailspodcast.com, Facebook page, Sinister Crimes and Cocktails, and our Instagram page, Sinister Crimes and Cocktails.
Love what you heard and want to help support our show or donate to our Sinister Cocktail Fund? You can donate to our Cash App at @SinisterCrimes, all one word, and we will give you a shout out on our next episode and which fund you donate to. Thank you.